You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters. Hello, you beautiful people. Table Talk is a guide to the future of food and nutrition, brought to you by Food Matters. In these podcasts, we chat with visionaries from across the food industry to discover the ideas that will transform our food landscape. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, I'm a broadcaster, and I'm a gastronaut. It's been a year now since the UK government launched a range of ideas to encourage more people to move towards a healthier weight. It's the new obesity strategy. It covered everything from calorie labelling to advertising bans on unhealthy foods, expanding weight management in the NHS. At the time, the reaction from the food industry was, to put it politely, well, they were pretty much unimpressed. There were suggestions that it was overly negative against particular foods rather than positively encouraging a healthy diet. And also that there weren't enough new ideas in there, no new thinking. Well, since then, we've seen further announcements from government aiming to motivate people to lose weight, to reduce childhood obesity, and there've been public consultations on some of the ideas in the original paper. So after a year of consultations and considerations, I'm really interested to find out what will be taken forward from this obesity strategy and how likely is it to work. Now, to discuss this, I'm joined by Dr. Jennifer Dixon, CEO of the Health Foundation. Hello there, Jennifer.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us. And Anna Taylor, Executive Director at the Food Foundation. Hello there, Anna.
Hi.
Brilliant to have you both. Now, before we dive into the specifics of this, let's take a step back and have a look at the issue here as a whole, obesity, something that successive governments have talked about for as long as I can remember, yet levels of obesity continue to rise. Has anything ever solved the obesity crisis? Jennifer?
Well, I think the short answer is no, because the trends are upwards, and about two-thirds of our adult population at the moment are obese or overweight, and most want to lose weight. And this isn't just our problem. It's a problem across the developed world, in fact. It just so happens that it's pretty bad in Britain. If you compare us to some of our Western European neighbours, for example, we are more overweight. And also the gap between rich and poor is growing as well. And it's not just a problem of adults, it's a problem of children too. And it's costing a huge amount, not just in health and lack of flourishing of our, you know, lack of well-being, but also it's costing the government a lot, the NHS a lot, employers a lot, all of us a lot. And it adds piled on ill health for later. So it's a big, big issue. There's no real dent in the problem. And so the question I think on the table here is, of all the things that have been tried, is it now time to soup up our intervention and really look at this in a very serious way, akin to what we're doing for climate change, and really getting onto this for the long term?
Mm-hmm. So, Anna, I find this absolutely fascinating because I'm not sure I've ever seen any data about real solutions for this area. I've seen a lot of money spent. Should government just say, oh, sod it? Or is it a question of making things less worse than it might otherwise be?
There's a few answers there. I think the problem that we've had is that it's sort of crept up on us. So this has happened a little bit each year until it's got to the point where you're looking at the stats and you're looking at the cost on the impact on the NHS and frankly on people's well-being and retirement periods and their general health. And you're realizing actually it's got to the point where now it's such a massive problem that unless we do something, we're looking at a situation very quickly where the impact on the NHS is going to be completely unsustainable. I turned 50 last week and I looked back at how much childhood obesity there was when I was a child, so in the 1970s. Yeah. So it was 1.9% of children were obese when I was in primary school. And now it's seven times that if you're in the most disadvantaged parts of the country. But it sort of shows that it's just creep, 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 creep. And we've now got a really crisis situation. So how does government respond to that? I think the point is that when you look back on the history of all these different things which have been tried, there are a few kind of key characteristics about the focus of those interventions. A lot of them have relied on us as citizens, consumers, doing things differently, taking more exercise, buying different things in the shops, giving us information about it. And some of that, quite a lot of that hasn't worked. So I think thinking about the problem differently is really important to thinking about then the sorts of things that are going to make a difference. And the other thing is, I think There's lots of little evaluations of small things that have worked in their own way, but trying to shift the dial at a national level is the really big challenge. And I don't know of any countries that have successfully done that in terms of obesity levels. There are some locations that have started to really slow down childhood obesity. There are some examples of where they've had a really big impact on consumption of foods, which we know are really bad. So there's little glimmers of hope, but really ramping that up to the point where you get a national shift is the big challenge we face.
Yeah. Well, happy birthday, by the way.
Thanks.
It's just such, as Anna says, this is a complex problem. It's multifaceted, complex, requiring long-term sustained commitment and attention. Governments aren't so good at complex problems.
Or long-term issues either.
Or long-term issues, exactly, which is why I think the climate change example is a really good one. And it's no one thing, there's no one silver bullet. I think we all know that. And it does require sustained action. So this is at the root, I think, of the problem. And the other thing that's at the root here is, do you as a government accept that the obesity problem is not all down to individual agency? It's not all down to willpower. And there's still quite a lot of people who believe that. And a lot of the public believe that too. But if you look at the kinds of figures that Anna has described, what life was like in the 70s, can you say that over time our biological substance has changed? No. Can you say that our willpower has changed over that time? No. What has changed? What has changed is the obesogenic environment, which we'll probably go on to describe. And that's what governments have to accept, that they have a role to change the weather on that obesogenic environment.
Okay, well, I could rant forever about the lack of any progress on anything. And I've been trying to get people to eat better for about 15 years now. It hasn't done a damn bit of difference. But anyway, that's not the point. The point is the obesity strategy. So let's cast our minds back to when the obesity strategy came out. There were some things that seemed like really good ideas. They were relatively small things, though, I thought. New labelling for calories on menus to help me make healthier choices, although that's complex in its own area. Calorie labelling on alcoholic drinks, I thought, was a really good idea. But again, it seemed like a tangential fringe thing to it. What did you make of the original proposals? And, you know, what were the good things, Anna? What did you think was fantastic about what was in the obesity strategy?
I thought that the recommendations, which have now, you know, seeing the light of day on advertising and on promotions, were really great. Mm-hmm. I think they were brave on the part of the government, and they were dealing with the fact that we've got to somehow get exposure of children down to some of these really unhealthy foods from when they're very young. And that's hard because they're exposed to so many different channels. And so no one's saying these are kind of magic bullets and they're going to suddenly transform the problem, but they were brave and important steps. And I think promotions, we're hearing from the supermarkets that they're having to reorganize their stores entirely to comply with the promotions restrictions. And that's a good thing in my view. We know that how the layout of the store and where things are positioned really matters when you're in habitual behaviors of rushing around, just trying to grab what you need to grab. Mm. And plus, of course, the promotions, we know that people buy much more than they need to. The whole system is geared up to do that around some of these, you know, the industry calls it expandability of categories. What are those categories where you get people to buy a bit more, they take it home, they eat it faster than they otherwise would, and then they go back for more. And these categories are kind of highly expandable, and it's concentrated on those foods which we know we should be eating a bit less of rather than more of. So I think those were two really important steps.
Yeah.
But they're just small building blocks on quite a big journey, and we've got to follow them up with more. And the other thing about these effects was what we call the balloon effect with the system. You sort of press it down in one place to try and dampen down the effects of something, and it pops up somewhere else, and then you've got to intervene there as well. So we have to be ready, as Jennifer said, for the long haul here, in building on intervention after intervention to try and get the system in the place where we need it to be.
That's a really good point. You know, the food industry is very good at finding new ways to make money from selling stuff to us. Now, Jennifer, do you think this is the same as Anna, the small building blocks, but maybe not enough big, broad strokes of genius that might solve the problem?
Yes, I think Anna's exactly right. And I read a paper recently which looked back over 28 years of government policy on obesity. And there's one strategy roughly every 2 years, each with an on average 35 recommendations. And what the authors noticed, which is Martin White and Dolly Thiss, was that the kinds of things that came forwards every 2 years were actually repeats of the previous lot, and very much focused on individual agency, which is what Anna is saying. So
do you think those are just crowd pleasers, things that look good in newspapers and reactionary types who end up throwing their votes behind people who say things they expect are pleased by those things?
I've no doubt there's genuine commitment here because it's consistent over time, whichever government seems to be introducing the strategy. But they are small steps and they are very slanted, as Anna is saying, towards individual agency and asking the individuals to take notice of the calorie labelling or the price promotions and so on. And the wider determinants of health, the wider determinants of obesity, which is wide in this obesogenic environment, which we can probably get onto, are never really part of the picture. And I think we're not going to tilt this landscape unless we do accept that and then start looking at it more carefully.
Yeah. Okay. Now, over the 12 months, what has changed, do you think, in the strategy, Anna? Have people's concerns been taken on, do you think, or is it pretty much what we saw a year ago?
Well, I think the COVID pandemic has changed how people think about this problem, or at least I think there's a consciousness about the public's health and our resilience as a nation to things like a global pandemic that has raised concerns and a worry that the UK may have somehow have been more exposed to the pandemic because of the health status that we went into this crisis with. And I think that has changed. I mean, certainly we hear that it's changed the Prime Minister's view on obesity and why he's personally taking this issue a lot more seriously. So I think that is one important factor to keep hold of. I think the other thing we've seen in the last 10 days or so is the launch of the National Food Strategy, which again is a ramping up of a set of recommendations in this area, not just to tackle obesity, but to actually improve our diets overall, which recommends a bold set of actions, including a sugar and salt tax, which I think build on this direction of travel that we've gone in here. So I would feel sort of cautiously optimistic that we're in a situation where we're more ready to embrace some stronger government intervention to reorient the system around us so that we aren't doing the heavy lifting as consumers or citizens, but it's just all made a bit easier for us to eat well.
The thing I probably would add to, I think Anna gave a great summary, is that the other thing we've seen in the last 12 months is increasing shareholder action through investors. So Share Action, for example, challenged Tesco PLC, the first UK listed company to be challenged with a shareholder resolution on health grounds, to disclose the share of total food and non-alcoholic drink annual sales by volume made up of healthier products, and to develop a strategy to increase that share by 2030 and to publish a review of its progress. So what I think we're beginning to see more of, and again, I'm thinking about the green agenda, is more investor action to try to encourage corporate responsibility. And I think that's another really good sign. So although we devote a lot of our effort to saying the government should do this and government do that, and actually it does hold a lot of the cards, I do think there's also other actors here. And I think the big investors, and actually if you think about some of the big investors, like the pension funds, they do have a long-term agenda. They do invest for a long term, over 30 years. Particularly, of course, they're interested in pension payouts and ill health. So I think that's also a very encouraging sign.
Yeah, I think things like that are really important. So Lidl, interestingly, has just recently pledged to increase the level of its healthy or healthier products from 80% now to 85% by 2025. I mean, to be honest, that sounds like a small amount to me, but for, you know, when we're talking about a major retailer, that takes a huge amount of effort, doesn't it?
I've noticed in the National Food Strategy that Anna referred to, that some of the CEOs of some of the larger food companies were saying that actually legislation on them would help, because otherwise, if they go out on a limb and do something alone, then competitors just fill the gap, that, you know, the balloon squeezes out in some other way. So oddly enough, regulation is something that some CEOs of large food companies or grocery stores is actually welcoming. And I think that's also another new thing that we've seen.
Yeah, because they're really after a level playing field, I guess. So they feel that they're not, you know, doing the things themselves that everyone really ought to do.
Indeed.
OK, now, Anna, last September, the National Audit Office reviewed the policy, made a bunch of recommendations. They want to see more urgency in the proposals, more targeting of funding towards local authorities and groups who have greater obesity problems. Has their advice been taken, do you think? Has the strategy been adapted according to everyone's thoughts, including your own and your organisation's?
I'm not aware that it has, specifically, particularly in terms of local authority funding. And I think they also pointed to the inequality. I mean, we've got this sort of on paper, not actually in last year. Oh, yes, last year's strategy, they did also say they wanted to narrow the gap, I think. But that target, which isn't really a target because it's just a sort of aspiration as expressed, really, rather than a sort of fixing a number on it, but has been in place for a while. And I think, I mean, you referred to sort of the wider determinants, Jennifer, of this problem. And I think that's been an area that's been really overlooked as like, okay, we've got some really important areas which will benefit everybody. But we know that if you're on a very low income, this is like 10 times harder for you to go on this journey for a whole ton of reasons. And that's the piece that feels very missing in this, the obesity strategies that we've seen so far. There's been some mention of it, but really substantively thinking about how we narrow the gap between rich and poor on diet inequality is really not, we're not grasping the nettle, I don't think, in any serious way.
The other thing in the obesity strategy, Anna, I thought was there's almost a total lack of case studies of where some of the most hard-pressed families, how difficult they find this whole issue to be, both cooking, both exercise, managing obesity, managing children's interest in fast food. And almost it to build this from the bottom up seems to be, to me, approach that I think could be pressed on more fully. You're closer to it, so I'd be interested in your view, but some communities are really affected, and are we listening enough to them to understand what the issues are, for which, you know, calorie labelling is probably makes no difference whatsoever to this family that doesn't cook together, doesn't eat together, parents have, or one parent has many jobs, can't necessarily sit down and cook. So that's something I particularly want to see if we're really serious about this.
So Anna, I mean, can we solve these problems? I mean, this is often problems of poverty and education that are really fundamental. Is that a separate problem, or can we tackle these things individually?
I think we should be careful not to kind of lump together the poverty and education, because actually the evidence suggests that cooking skills, for example, is poor across whether you're rich or poor. It's just right. That if you're rich and you've got no cooking skills, you can go and buy something expensive that's pre-prepared and quite healthy. Yeah. And if you're poor, that's a lot harder to find something that's pre-prepared, yeah, that's healthy and very, yeah, cheap. I mean, the evidence suggests that if people have more money, then they tend to prioritize better food quite quickly. And actually, there's also some evidence that they will spend less on things like alcohol and tobacco because there's less stress at home as well. So you kind of actually get some of those double whammies where people very quick to say, if you give people cash, you spend it on rubbish, and they spend it on, you know, they sort of trot out these kind of preconceptions, which when you look at the evidence are frankly wrong. And the evidence suggests that there are large numbers of families in Britain whose income is just so low that they actually face periods where there's not enough money to put any food on the table, let alone decent food. So that is a problem. It's a problem that can be dealt with through wage levels and benefit. I mean, that's how people get their money. It's not rocket science to try and solve this, but it is a question of how we prioritize resources. And then I think when you get into the other stuff beyond cost, there's obviously a set of programs which are in place to protect children, things like free school meals, Healthy Start program, that all provide this sort of vital nutritional guarantee when kids are in particular settings where you can say, right, we know we're going to really use the public purse to make sure you get that decent meal each day, and we know that's vital for your health and development. So there are those things that we can use. And then there's more broadly the sorts of things which are sort of the wider factors, so around housing, so where people could be in a situation where all they've got is a kettle to cook with. I mean, imagine trying to cook a decent meal with just a kettle. You're really, really stuck. Many people don't even have a fridge. I mean, so when you're in that, you're then into the sort of housing sector and, okay, what are the minimum requirements for landlords in terms of what they put in place for the people that are renting accommodation from them? So there's no doubt it's complicated, but it's not that difficult if you just put the resources in the right place, you know?
It's those resources that are a problem, though,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so let's look at a couple of the specifics. You mentioned already the advertising ban. Now, we did a podcast with a couple of members of the advertising agency. They were, I would say the word apoplectic with rage is appropriate. And they were saying that research has shown that it makes a difference of one calorie per day for children. But this is something that the government has committed to. There's going to be a TV advertising ban up to 9 p.m. and online restrictions as well. Do you think this is going to have a fundamental change? Is it going to have an impact, Jennifer?
Well, again, it's a start and it's a signal. And I think the idea that any one thing is going to really turn the dial is probably quite naive, whether it's that or the sugar tax. Mm-hmm. I think there are two things with the 9 p.m. One is that a lot of children are staying up after 9 p.m. and will see TV. And, you know, one would expect the advertisers to simply shift their advertising to put more advertising to substitute for the loss before nine. Mm. And then the other thing is, of course, TV watching by children is declining in favor of online watching. So there, I think the idea of a total ban is something that's being mooted, isn't it? And
yeah.
I think that's possibly likely to be most effective. But also not forgetting that some places that are advertising unhealthy food with high fat, sugar, salt may also be selling healthy food. So that's also something to watch, where they are still there and their brand is still there, even though something healthy is being advertised, because there's a long trail of unhealthy food in that store. So I think it's a step in the right direction. But, you know, I don't think we should think that that's going to turn the dial here.
It's part of a greater whole, I guess. There's also talk of a reward system to motivate people to lose weight. Is this workable, Anna? What are your thoughts about? I mean, it's innovative, but there's lots of other innovative things you could do, such as prescribing carrots, I guess. You know, what do you think the reward systems to motivate people to lose weight are workable?
I think we need to be careful not to put too much effort into the exercise basket for losing weight. The evidence suggests that exercise can help with maintaining your weight once you've lost some weight, but really it's diet that is going to make a difference to losing weight. And so I think if those incentives could be oriented around helping people to afford healthier food, then yes, that's a good route to consider, I think. I mean, we know, for example, the Healthy Start Scheme, it provides fruit and veg vouchers for mums who are on a very low income, who've got very young children. And we know that the evidence shows that those vouchers mean that those families on average buy 14% more fruit and veg than they would before. And that could be the difference between having fruit hidden away somewhere because it's such a treat to having a fruit bowl on the table so the kids can eat it when they want to. You know, we know that those things, incentives, whether those are, if those are financial incentives, they work well. And in fact, I mean, when you talk to the retailers, some of them have set up kind of games and things like that with their loyalty cards for getting people to kind of try and meet fruit and veg targets and all that kind of thing. I think, you know, all of those things, if they make the journey enjoyable and engaging for people, great. I mean, at the end of the day, we're talking about food, which is supposed to be something which we all take pleasure from, or, you know, many of us do in different situations take pleasure from. So I think building that into this journey is quite important.
Are you saying that we shouldn't strap people to chairs and force carrots into their mouths? I don't know. What's wrong with you people? Too liberal for me. Okay, what about talking about the food industry, or talking to the food industry, Jennifer? Do you think that there's enough to positively encourage the food industry? I mean, they are not the individual actors. They are the people making money from this. But there are other issues as well. There's social issues. There's the NHS. There's healthcare. Although I have to say, most of their approaches to try and get people to eat well, I don't feel have made much of a dent in nutritional balance, personally. Do you think that there is enough stick and not enough carrot used with the approach to the food industry, and should that change?
I think it's possibly the other way around, actually, that there's not enough stick. And I think if you just look at the trends that we described earlier, it is phenomenal and remarkable, the problem that we've now grown into, as it were, forgive the pun. And really something has got to change. It's not all down to food and what we eat, although that is a significant problem, as we've been describing. And also, we haven't even talked about the volume of ultra-processed food that seems to be more highly consumed over here. But I think the steps that we have taken so far are really quite tentative with the food industry. And I think there are signs now. I think the sugar levy, I think, is something that we've started. I would like that to go a lot further. I think we should listen to the food industry that talks about more legislation to create this level playing field. There's a lot more, but understanding that the food industry is only one part, that it is a significant part. Mm. So more steps, too tentative at the moment, and I don't think they're going to really turn the dial on this one.
Okay, so are you not impressed, basically?
No, I think bottom line, I'm not. I think some sensible steps have been taken, and they're encouraging, as Anna says, but they are really slow. Mm. And if you even think of some of the targets set for the junk food ban, for example, you know, they're still in the future. They're not sudden, because they're giving businesses chance to change their behaviour and prepare. But nevertheless, it seems very slow and very tentative, yeah, in the face of these trends, which are phenomenal. But having said that, this is only one area of action, but it's a significant one.
Yeah. Anna, I mean, what do you think about this? Do you sit there and go, come on, people, just get a grip and do X? You know, why don't you do this particular thing? Is there a frustration? And what is it that you want to kick people up the bum to do?
Yeah, I mean, I think everything that's proposed takes years to see the light of day. And that period usually gives everyone a chance to nibble away at the edges of it and water it down. Mm. And I think we see quite a lot of that. So, yeah, it is very frustrating. And I think, I mean, when you set aside the sort of economic challenge of the NHS and you just see an adolescent that's already got type 2 diabetes, or a child that's had all of their teeth taken out because of sugar, you know, it kind of brings you up short and thinks, gosh, you know, we've really, the urgency around this problem is so utterly preventable. Mm. that we really need to be moving faster. And I understand that these interventions by government burn up political capital. You can't be, you know, naive about that.
Yeah.
But I think we've all seen this year how important the NHS is to us as a nation. It's sort of in our DNA in a way that has never been before. And I think we have to take seriously what's happening as a result of our diets to the NHS. So I think it's getting to the point where government, I hope, is really grasping the urgency and being emboldened to act. I mean, we haven't seen the real signs of that yet, but let's see what happens in response to the National Food Strategy, what happens next with the next stage of the obesity strategy. And I think we have to be sending all the right signals to the heart of government to say that this is, it's patently what people want. I mean, when you talk to people, whether they're in a deprived community, something, they want help. Mm. People need help from the system around them. They can't do it on their own. And we need to recognise that.
Yeah.
There is a question, you know, government's strategy at the moment seems to be focused a lot on levelling up, doesn't it?
Well, they say that.
They say that. And, you know, we await the government's levelling up strategy this autumn. The question is it going to be something beyond bridges, broadband, grey infrastructure and some skills? And could it involve health in some way? Because can you say Britain is prospering unless our health is prospering? Can you have a prospering economy if 2/3 of people in an area are too ill to work, which is what's happening in some areas that are in need of levelling up? So given that a lot of money is going to be swilling around on levelling up, relatively speaking, can we hitch the obesity and health to this strategy in order to get some sense? Mm. In a sense, the government has slightly done that with, it has a green agenda, the 10-point plan for that is linked to the economic plan for growth, as it said, but it hasn't yet linked health to that. So I think that's another opportunity.
Yeah. Now, I don't want to end this on a negative note, but what is the likely impact of this not working if just another obesity strategy has to be brought in 2030? If this doesn't work, if this doesn't solve some of the bigger problems facing us, Anna, what is likely to be the impact?
Well, I mean, this, in terms of the strategy on paper, is not going to solve it. I mean, I think we have to be clear about that. As we've said, the stuff that's in the current strategy is good baby steps.
Yeah.
When's the next strategy? It needs to be now, and it needs to build on it if we're going to get anywhere close. I mean, we won't hit halving childhood obesity by 2030, that's patently clear. Mm-hmm. But if we're going to move the needle, then we need more than we've got now. If we don't hit it, we don't make any progress, you have to remember with obesity is this sort of incremental thing. So, you know, a child that is 5 years old today, overweight and obese, they're likely to track through adulthood, but they also gain more weight, and more kids then get heavier as they join the cohort, if you like. So it's like this, you know, we've got a huge lag in the system before we really start to stem the flow. You know, we're looking at decades of being able to get out, really getting out of this from an NHS as a sort of older life treatment perspective, which is, again, why we need to get on with it now, because we're dealing with this sort of big lag time anyway. And so I think we're going to be in even more, I mean, we'll be in a situation, we know now that if people are overweight or obese and they go, their NHS costs for any hospital admission are sometimes up to 2 times more than somebody with a low BMI. So it brings with it a set of complications for treatment. So the cost per person goes up, regardless of what they're being treated for, and the numbers are going up. So we're in a situation where it's going to be all the NHS is doing. So I think we've got to be very mindful of the fact that we've got a lot of other things that we need the NHS to be doing to take care of us in our, well, throughout our lives, but particularly when we're older.
So, Jennifer, I mean, the dangers of not getting this right are immense. We've seen how appalling the life can be for people within the NHS when it's overwhelmed. And if obesity is just becoming a bigger and bigger problem, that's going to cause, I mean, huge potential dangers for us. And also, we need to remember that health does, to some extent, equal happiness, and that the misery that illnesses associated with obesity can cause are awful for the population as a whole. What are the biggest dangers for you?
Well, I think all of those, I mean, it's the cost to individuals first and foremost, and their lives and their health. I think the cost to the NHS, which has been cashed out, is £6.1 billion a year. That's out of a £130 billion budget. There's cost to social care as well, if more older people are getting obese and sicker. There's a cost to the country with respect to employment. You know, if more ill health is occurring in under 65s, that means people are out of the workforce at a time when we need to be competitive, and perhaps we have less access to workers from other countries because of choices that we've made. So what's stunning about all of this is that although it's very, very complicated, it is avoidable, as Anna is saying. It is, we can turn the tide. And I think that's why I kind of want to link this a bit to the green agenda. I think there is hope. You know, it wasn't so long ago that we were telling ourselves we can't really do much on green. It's all too complicated. No one is. But we are, and there's leadership. And I think this needs sustained commitment. This crosses party lines. This crosses our ideology. Even if you know, on the one hand, believe in libertarian politics, the other end, you believe in the large role of the state. What you can see in front of you literally is that this problem is getting worse. So that requires us to focus a lot more on evidence as well about what is working and course correcting. We will have another strategy, I've no doubt, in 2 years' time, which will turn up the thumb screws a little bit more and try to act. But again, that will be inadequate. And then there'll be another one. So it's amazing the kind of almost the blindness about this issue. Like many other aspects of social policy, if I might say, there's a sort of cognitive blindness in policymakers, despite commitment, once you really show them the figures.
Yeah. Well, let's hope that these different steps actually go in the right direction. And I think there's some great ideas knocking around. They just need to be put into practice. Dr. Jennifer Dixon and Anna Taylor, thank you so much for talking to me today. You've been listening to the Table Talk podcast brought to you by Food Matters. And if you enjoyed this episode, you might like one of our other podcasts in which we explore pretty much every aspect of the food industry. Some of my favourites have been the look at science behind fuller for longer food, the episode on chrononutrition and how nutrition is impacted by the time we eat. Follow to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, take a look at foodmatters.co.uk. Thanks for listening.